I thought since we were in the bicentennial that it was about time that I take another look at the Federalist Papers. The last time I studied the Federalist Papers was about 22 years ago, and I think maybe once or twice I have looked at them since then. And so among the books which I brought up to Holden this year was a copy of the Federalist Papers. And I will be engaged in talking about them from today through Saturday, skipping Friday, when we'll at this time probably be dedicating something around here. But today I'm going to try and give you a historical background both of the papers and of the men who wrote them, and give you some idea of their importance, and then we'll be engaged with certain of the papers and the rest of the days, certain of the papers which have been important and which I think are significant and important today. All righty. On September 17, 1787, a convention which had been meeting since May in Philadelphia concluded its deliberations, called itself a Constitution Convention, and it adjourned having passed two resolutions. One, that a particular constitutional document be adopted, and the second, that each of the 13 states, which had been rather loosely cooperating with one another for about 5 or 6 years, that each of them, each of their legislatures elect a convention committee which would study this document and then vote whether to ratify it or not. Now, this was a rather radical thing. Both of these seem sort of innocuous today in the light of history, but both of these were very radical kind of actions by that group. Because number one, that group had been called together to study the Articles of Confederation, which were the sort of constitutional document with which 13 colonies had been operating since the American Revolution, and which had not been working out too successfully, and they had been asked to take a look at the document and to suggest some minor revisions which would make life easier. Now, at the time that they were selected to do this task, they were selected in the context of an idea that what was to happen on the American continent was that there would be a loose confederation of 13 states, perhaps more would be added later on, who knew, but that each of these states would be operating virtually autonomously, and that the confederation's intent was simply to handle any minor little problems as might happen to arise between them, and to serve as a kind of a coordinating agency in case there were any kind of common activities in which they'd have to engage. What this committee did rather rapidly was to adopt a totally new constitution, a constitution which removed a great deal of state power and centralized it in a national government. So they made a radical change. They did something they had not been instructed to do. And not only did they do that, but they acted as though they had been instructed to do it, and they presented it, you know, here's the result of our deliberations. And they proposed that for the first time in history, that people would get together and would decide what kind of government they were going to have. They would pass on a constitution. Now, for all practical purposes, the American Constitution is the first modern constitution. The ancient Greeks had known many constitutions. We know that when Aristotle was working on the document which later got the name the Politics, he studied 100 constitutions of city-states existing at his time. So the idea of a constitution for a country was not unknown. But at the time of the American Constitution, there just weren't any countries that had a constitutional base. about the closest you came to it was Great Britain, and a collection of various documents which had accrued over a period of time. But, you know, this was not the ultimate in British operation, and also the British Parliament was always free to innovate and to change. For instance, the British Parliament could decide, and has frequently, to suspend elections because of an emergency time and the incumbents continue. For instance, during World War II, there were no elections to the House of Commons in Great Britain. It was a time of emergency, and they voted not to have to run for office again until after the war, and they didn't. And it was perfectly permissible. In the United States of America, we had elections as usual because the Constitution called for it. Well, I mean, this is a basic difference. Well, anyway, the idea of a constitutional government was a resurrected idea from antiquity. And the idea that people would be elected in each of the states to study the document and then vote on it, and people would sit and wait and see whether they got enough votes for it to become official. This was a totally new idea, and it was a radical experiment. Probably at the time that the convention completed its work, the majority of the states, if called on to vote, would have voted against the new constitution which was proposed. One of the areas of the new country which was strongly anti-new constitution was the future state of New York. The governor of the state of New York was a man named Clinton. The name Clinton occurs frequently in New York politics. The governor was a man named Clinton who was very strongly a straits right man. When he selected the delegation which was to go to Philadelphia to consider the Articles of Confederation, he had three men that he sent. He sent two men who were very strongly states rights men, and a third man was a guy named Alexander Hamilton, who was very strongly pro-strong central government. His ideal of an almost perfect government was the government of George III, Great Britain, the guy against whom they had fought in the American Revolution. And so there was a three-man delegation, two of whom were states' riders, and the third one was a strong central government type guy. Well, each state was allowed one vote on that, and so consequently they would caucus, you know, pass their vote, and the majority of the delegation, that was the voice of the state. So you can imagine how much voice Alexander Hamilton had at the Constitution Convention. And as a result, he soon gave up and went home. He wasn't getting anywhere. He'd vote for any plank that was strong central government, and the other two guys voted against it, and New York's vote was cast against it. So he finally gave up and went home, and the New Yorkers were losing after a while, and they quit. So that when they got to the end of the deliberations, Hamilton showed up once again in Philadelphia, and since his delegation had voted to disband, he couldn't vote. So when they got around on the final day to casting the yeas and nays on the final constitutional document, Hamilton voted as an individual. Couldn't vote the New York vote because the delegation had disbanded, so he voted as an individual for it. Okay, well, between that time, September 17th, 1787, and sometime in 1788, was campaign time for and against the Constitution in the state of New York. And between October 27th, in 1787 and April 4th in 1788, 77 articles of varying lengths appeared in the New York newspapers, signed with the name Publius, Mr. Public. Now, at this time it was customary, as a matter of fact it continued all the way to the Civil War, it was customary for people who were would-be writers, usually on political or social subject, to submit articles to newspapers, local newspapers, over a Roman name. And depending on where their sentiments lay, would determine, you know, who, how they signed their letter. If the guy was particularly malicious and vindictive, maybe he'd sign his name after one of the vicious Roman Caesars. Julius Caesar was a popular pseudonym for someone who was of a sort of military bent. There's some reason to believe that Alexander Hamilton signed a few letters that were violently anti-Articles of Confederation with the name Julius Caesar. A friend of his wrote a couple letters and signed them Brutus, which wasn't too bright, because they didn't know Brutus as the great conservative Republican of the Roman Republic, but they knew Brutus as the guy, you know, who cheated on his friend Julius, you know, and so he didn't succeed too well. But at any rate, Governor Clinton had begun to publish a bunch of articles in the papers that were anti-new constitution, and he signed his letters Cato, against in memory of the great Roman lawyer and senator. Well, here comes Publius, and nobody knew who Publius was. As a matter of fact, for many years, nobody knew who Publius was. But 77 articles appeared, discussing and defending various aspects of the new Constitution. On March 22nd, a book appeared entitled The Federalist, in which all of the articles which thus far had appeared in the newspaper were collected together. And it sold rather well, not only in New York State, but also in other states. On the 28th of May, a second volume appeared with the rest of the 77 articles and an additional 8 more articles that had not appeared in the New York papers, making a total of 85 articles. Now, these articles varied from, in a book this size, pages that size, you know, normal, nice size, tight, easy reading, 2.5 pages to about 7 pages. You know, so they weren't great big long things, little ones and larger ones. And the two volumes were entitled The Federalist. Well, for those of you that have some familiarity with recent Missouri Synod history, this had the effect on a certain constituency, as happened about 5 or 6 years ago when a certain group in the Missouri Synod identified themselves as moderate. Yeah. Immediately, another group got madder than all get out. Well, the men who had written the Federalist Papers, you know, called themselves Federalists. And Clinton and his buddy said, "That's not federalism. That's nationalism. They're not advocating a federation of autonomous, powerful states. They're advocating a national government, and they call themselves Federalists." Well, the title hung in there to such an extent that once the nation got going under the new Constitution, one of the parties which formed, and the man who was behind the Federalist Papers was the first head of the party, he was called the Federalist Party. And it was opposed for a time by a group led by Thomas Jefferson, which called itself the Republican Party. Later on, and of course, became the party we know as the Democratic Party. It called itself the Republican Party, and then there were arguments, divisions, so that the guy who was the head of the Federalist Party then became one of Jefferson's primary supporters in 1800, then the Republican Party, and helped to get Jefferson elected president, and, you know, such are the vagaries of political history. Well, at any rate, the Federalist. Governor Clinton and his buddies were all very unhappy about this. The purpose of these articles was to persuade New Yorkers to ratify the new Constitution. Finally, in the
oh, probably about May of 1788, the persons who were to vote on the ratification of the new constitution were selected, and they met on June 17th to begin deliberations. At that point, there were 19 of them who were for the new constitution, 46 were against it, as they first met to discuss. So you can see how terrifically influential the Federalist Papers had been. Absolute bomb. Didn't make it at all. No influence whatsoever. Number two, the articles of the Federalist Papers discussed the Constitution. Now, in the preamble to the Constitution, there were six ideas that were set forth that government was supposed to achieve. And among these ideas, that government was supposed to achieve or defend was justice, secure justice for the citizenry, promote the general welfare, and secure liberty for all of the citizens. What do the Federalist Papers say about justice? It gets a brief mention in one article. What does it say about the general welfare? Absolutely nothing. What does it say about liberty? Al won't be quoting the Federalist Papers when he talks about liberty this week. It doesn't say anything about liberty. Well, what does it talk about? The Federalist Papers are not high-level political philosophy. They are not concerned with ideas and ideals. They are concerned with down-to-earth, nitty-gritty practical politics. And they talk on the practical level, and they say if you do government this kind of way, this is the sort of thing that will happen. If you do it this kind of way, this is the sort of thing that's going to happen. These are the kind of problems you have with government. Our proposed way of doing it is going to work out this way, and so on. So it's done on a very practical politician's kind of level. At the same time, it is rather sophisticated. Well, so this is the general kind of setting, brief backgrounding on the Federalist Papers, and we're going to spend 4 days on it. We're going to spend 4 days on a document which was published anonymously to persuade New York voters to ratify a constitution, and it failed, and it doesn't even devote itself to some of the key ideas that we believe in. Why should we spend 4 days on that? Well, I could say why, but somebody rather well said it. The Federalist Papers have an extremely high position in American history, primarily because of the quality of their analysis of principles which have been of central importance in the development of modern political and constitutional help and constitutional thought. The great paradox of the history of the Federalist is that it has oftentimes been called one of the classics of political thought, and yet it is almost never dealt with as anything more than a national monument. You know, people say, oh yes, the Federalist Papers, you know, they nods. So you'll be some of the few people in the United States in this bicentennial year that will be rubbing shoulders with Federalist Papers. A work that needs to be sampled only through a few carefully selected paragraphs. That's a general kind of idea, and unfortunately that's pretty much what I'm going to be doing. Shame on me. And many books of lesser content and political thought get a great deal more attention than the Federalist Papers. Scholarly writers on the history of Western political thought either ignore it or dispose of it with a few generalities. And even the Encyclopedia of the Social Sciences, which is one of the Bibles of the social sciences, contains only a few scattered and time-tested statements about the book that Jefferson called the best commentary on the principles of government that was ever written. Okay, who wrote it? The guiding mind behind the Federalist Papers was Alexander Hamilton. He also wrote most of the articles. As a matter of fact, he probably wrote 51 of the 85. And I say probably because shortly before Alexander Hamilton went for his fatal duel with Aaron Burr, perhaps suspecting that he wasn't going to come back from it, he left a little note in a copy of the Federalist Papers for a friend of his. And on this note, he wrote down, according to his best recollection, which articles he wrote and which articles were written by the other two men who wrote articles of the Federalist Papers. Another one of the writers, I'll tip him off as time goes by this morning, another one of the writers gave another list. And the list which we go by today is the result of some judicious decision making and a certain amount of use of the historical critical method, you know, and working with a typology of style and things of that sort. But anyway, we think that probably Alexander Hamilton wrote 51 of the 85 articles and contributed some material for three other ones that were written by another man. He wrote the first one, which is the introductory one, 6 to 9, 11 to 13, 15 to 17, 21 to 36, 59 to 61, and 64 to 85. As I mentioned before, he was the minority delegate of the New York delegation to the Constitutional Convention at Philadelphia. He was in favor of a very strong central government and a very strong executive. And as I mentioned before also, he was consistently outvoted by his fellow delegates and finally quit. He returned for the last days of the convention to argue on the floor for the new constitution and to vote for it as an individual. It was not as strong a constitution as he wanted, but it was better than the Articles of Confederation. One of many fascinating things about the Federalist Papers, which are among constitutional scholars considered the best commentary on the Constitution. One of the surprising things about it is none of the three guys who wrote the articles really wanted that Constitution. They wanted a more powerful Constitution than that one. And they settled for that one because it was better than what they had. And it was men with this mentality that wrote this commentary and defense of the Constitution. Okay. His years are 1755 to 1804, and he is the youngest of the three writers of the Federalist Papers. He was born in the British West Indies. He was an illegitimate child because his mother was not divorced from her former husband until he was 3 years old, at which point his mother married his natural father. He and his mother and older brothers and sisters were abandoned by their father at the age of 10, when he was 10, on the island of St. Croix. At the age of 11, he began to work as a clerk in a mercantile office of a company whose headquarters were in New York. His mother died in 1768, so you see he was 13 years old. He became office manager of that office in 1771 when he was 16 years old. The firm was so impressed with him and his ability that 2 years later they sent him to the continent of America for a better education. He spent about a year at a prep school in Elizabethtown, New Jersey, and in the fall of 1773, in October, he entered King's College, which later on would be called Columbia University, of which you may have heard. He was very gung-ho in favor of the American Revolution. Well, you know, most students were, university students, they're for that sort of thing, aren't they? And that's natural. He was very gung-ho for the American Revolution. He wrote three pamphlets against the British position and defending the American position on the issues, and all three pamphlets were extremely influential at the time and, of course, got the attention of the men who were running the revolution on the American side. 1776, he enlisted in the army, and he was given a commission as a captain. He fought with his detachment. He was in charge of an artillery detachment. He fought against Cornwallis at Trenton. And largely through the efforts of his guns, they were successful in holding Cornwallis off until Washington could escape with the main army from Trenton. Washington noticed him and his abilities, and in 1777 he made him his aide-de-camp, you know, his personal right-hand man. At this time, Alexander Hamilton was 22 years old. There are an awful lot of kids in the American Revolution. He served for 4 years as Washington's right-hand man. So through most of the war, he was Washington's right-hand man. He wrote Washington's letters for him. I mean, he was his scribe, and Washington dictated to him. He handled a few diplomatic matters for Washington, and also because he was very fluent in French, having come from the West Indies, he was Washington's liaison man with the French military forces that in the latter part of the war, you know, were over fighting on our side under Lafayette. In 1780, he had time enough to get married. And being a guy who was illegitimate and came from nothing, and being a self-made man and being very conscious of his illegitimacy, he, you know, he acted in sort of typical fashion. And he found himself a good-looking, wealthy girl from a distinguished Dutch New York family and married her. So he married one of the Schuylers. You know, even today, the Schuyler name is one of the distinguished New York names. Well, he married Betsy Schuyler. But he also got restless at this time. You'd think he'd been very happy being Washington's right-hand man at headquarters, but he wanted to go where the action was. I suppose he realized that if anybody was going to get somewhere politically, he'd have a military career behind him and not behind a desk in the military. So he deliberately picked a fight with Washington so that he would get fired. And apparently Washington saw through the strategy, because while on the one hand he released him, on the other hand he saw to it that he got a command as a lieutenant colonel. And he had a detachment just in time to fight in the last battle of the war at Yorktown. And, you know, being Alexander Hamilton, he got his boys right in the middle of the action, and they went up and took one of the British fortifications before Cornwallis, you know, realized the impossibility of the situation and quit. So Alexander Hamilton got in on one of the few skirmishes at Yorktown. Okay, after the war, he studied law and was admitted to the bar in 1782, and shortly thereafter, he was elected to the Continental Congress from the state of Washington. By the way, one of the fascinating things about the American Revolutionary War, and a thing that we don't often realize, is that that is one of the few wars in history that was run by a committee. The Continental Congress ran the Revolutionary War for, you know, for the rebel side. And, you know, we say all sorts of things, you know, about if you want something to really get screwed up, turn it over to a committee, or no good thing was ever achieved by a committee, and so on. And this was one time that a committee managed to pull something off successfully. But it was run by the Continental Congress. Okay, now they had to, you know, get things organized, get things going, and they, you know, they in rather short order adopted the Articles of Confederation, which didn't work too successfully. Alexander Hamilton was appointed to the Constitutional Conference at Philadelphia in 1787 when he was 32 years old. While there, he made one major speech. And in this major speech, he advocated that they establish a government like the government of George III of England, but dividing the powers of government into three parts: executive, legislative, and judicial, as Montesquieu had proposed. And Montesquieu was the infallible authority on the Constitution as far as they were all concerned. He suggested that the legislature be divided into two houses, a lower house composed of males of voting age who would be elected to 3-year terms, an upper house called a Senate, where by an indirect process, men would be elected for lifetime service, sort of like the Roman Republic, except elective rather than hereditary office. The president should be elected for life by a double set of electors. An upper house called a Senate, where by an indirect process, men would be elected for lifetime service, sort of like the Roman Republic, except elective rather than hereditary office. The president should be elected for life by a double set of electors. The president should possess an absolute veto, in other words, Congress be unable to override a presidential veto, and that the president also appoint the governors of all the states. These governors of all the states would possess an absolute veto over their legislature's actions. That all members of the Supreme Court be appointed for life. You can imagine how popular Alexander Hamilton was at Philadelphia. All right, now, this is the man who was really the brains behind the Federalist Papers, and you can see his own preference and the kind of almost absolutistic government that he was in favor of. And yet, he is the man who is primarily responsible for the Federalist Papers, which are one of the finest expositions of and defense of the American Constitution. And so you see how far it was and is from his own ideas and his own preferences. Okay, well, of course, as you all know, when Washington became president, one of his first appointments was Alexander Hamilton as Secretary of the Treasury in September of 1789. One of the first things he did was develop a system for paying off state and national debts incurred during the Revolutionary War. Now, the popular attitude at that time was, particularly about debts to British citizens, was, so the war's over? Tough. Let them go whistle if they want to get paid. Let's just cancel all debts and start out fresh. Hamilton was successful in convincing the Congress that this kind of approach was not going to build fiscal integrity for the new country. The first thing they had to do was to get their credit established. And the only way they were going to get their credit established, as well as their credibility established as a nation, was to acknowledge and pay all debts. And so first he worked out a system for determining what would the legitimate recognized debts of the federal government and the states would be, and then worked out a taxation system whereby in fairly short order they could get the debts paid off and also develop an ongoing income and revenue system. He also developed a federal banking system. He was very anti-political party, as was Thomas Jefferson. And it's surprising that these two men who were strongly anti-political parties would both become heads of political parties. Both of them believed, as did James Madison, in a natural aristocracy, that some people are born to rule. It has nothing to do with breeding or wealth or culture or anything. You're just born this way. And so one of the problems of government is to discover who is suited to rule, you know, and put power and ability together. If you can pull that one off, you got a good government, and you'll always have a good government. Find the right man. And they literally meant that, the right man. So why have a political party? Political party, you know, as we know from sad history, more often than not comes up with the wrong man. And we come up to election day and we say, who do we vote for? They're both lousy. Right? Well, Jefferson and Hamilton both felt this way, and they felt that somehow or other ability would emerge if only we didn't set up artificial organizations like political parties and things like that that mechanically selected candidates, that men would emerge to meet the times. It's sort of like the old show business myth about talent will exert itself. And if you've got talent, sooner or later you're going to make it to Broadway. Well, they had this same kind of mystical idea about the natural aristocracy emerging. But parties began to form, and he was prevailed upon to head the Federalist Party, which is the first party, I think, to disappear also in American history. 1795, he went out of the cabinet. Was highly unpopular at the time, and something that's not too well known, and that is that when Washington completed his second term of office and refused to be considered for more terms because he didn't believe in hereditary rule and it would start looking like that, the guy who wrote Washington's farewell address, you know, the one about foreign entanglements, was Alexander Hamilton. He was very anti-John Adams, who was the next guy elected. You know, John Adams was one of the, you know the saying about the Adamses talk to the Adams, or was it, the Cabots talk only to the Adamses and the Adamses talk only to God. You know, it was true back in those days also. And Hamilton, being illegitimate foreigner up from the British West Indies, you can imagine his attitude about the Boston Blue Noses who came over on the Mayflower. That kind of attitude. So he was very strongly against John Adams and for Thomas Jefferson. Through his entire career, he was a controversial person. He several times was influential in preventing Aaron Burr from getting advancement on the national level, and on the final occasion when he succeeded in supporting the Republican candidate against Aaron Burr, I think for the governor of New York, Aaron Burr challenged him to a duel and he was killed. July 11, 1804. Or he was fatally wounded. He died the next day. 3 years before that, his oldest son had been killed at the same place in a duel.
So it's a little tragedy there. He left a wife and 7 children, deeply in debt. And his friends, of whom he had many, paid off the debt and looked after his wife and children. Okay, the guy who wrote 2, 3, 4, 5, and 64 of the Federalist Papers was a man named John Jay. I have a note on the side here. He was the Averill Harriman of his day, who would correspond to Alexander Hamilton. Oh, that's hard to say. Oh, maybe a guy like Henry Kissinger, although Henry's birth is legitimate in many ways. You know, he's kind of that sort of a person. And a kind of a one-man operator, although a much better organizer than Kissinger is. Kissinger is more of a I'll-do-it-myself type guy. Okay, but anyway, John Jay was the Averill Harriman of his day. To really appreciate John Jay, I'll have to read his full name. John Van Cortlandt Jay, from one of the better old Dutch families of New York. One of the distinguished families. Man who was a born diplomat, and who spent most of his career in the diplomatic service of the United States. The articles on foreign policy relative to the Constitution are the ones which Jay wrote. And it's very obvious that Hamilton asked the best diplomat in America to write those articles. Jay had no connection with the Constitution Convention in Philadelphia. He was not a delegate. And so consequently, his presentations about the Constitution are based on his conversations with Hamilton and his personal study of the document, and not having been a part of the struggles of the formulation of the document. As a matter of fact, the only one who was really in there and involved in the forging of the document is the third speaker, about whom I'll tell you shortly. And I better hurry on, I won't get to him today. Okay, he was 10 years older than Hamilton. He was born in 1745. He came from a strict Calvinist family, as you might have expected, you know, being Dutch. In 1764, he graduated from King's College, Columbia University. He got his M.A. in political science in 1767, and in 1768 he passed his bar examination, became a practicing lawyer, and shortly developed a very good practice, as guys from the big city who come from distinguished wealthy families usually do, right? He married a daughter of another first family of New York, and you know, so they became first among the first. He was against the revolution. He was on the colonist side. And once the revolution started, he was on the colonist side. But he was against the idea of a revolution, and he tried, being a natural diplomat, he tried everything he could to prevent revolution. But when it finally happened, then he was on the colonist side. In 1777, he wrote the New York Constitution and became New York State's first Chief Justice. In 1778, he was elected to the Continental Congress. He had been elected to it once before, and was immediately chosen as President of the Congress. So he was, you know, a very important man. He was sent by the Continental Congress as Minister Plenipotentiary to Spain in 1779. Our relationship with Spain during the American Revolutionary War is not particularly well known. Our relationship with Spain was extremely important because Spain owned Florida on west through Louisiana on the eastern seaboard. And so consequently, if Spain would go in on the side of Great Britain, who held New York, Philadelphia, that area, you know, and the Spanish started coming up from the south, you know, you got troubles. And so they had to keep Spain happy. In addition to which, they were very concerned that the British would not be able to supply troops and supplies going up the Mississippi to
what today is Illinois and Indiana and that area, where they had some outpost garrisons, and have the British come in then from the west over the mountains and hit the colonists behind their back. And so they had to seal off the Mississippi to prevent the British from getting in there. Well, the Mississippi was controlled by the Spanish at this time. Soon they would lose it to the French, and then we'd buy it from the French in about 1804. But right at this time it was Spanish. And so Jay was sent to the court at Madrid to keep Spain neutral, if not on our side. Was not particularly successful in positive achievement, but he did keep the Spanish out of the war. When the war ended then, a peace conference was conducted first in England and then finally in Paris, and since he already was in Madrid, he was selected as one of the commissioners to go over to London and meet with the British, and he was very influential there. Sounds almost like the Vietnam situation, because the French were involved as well as the colonists, because obviously the French had fought on our side. The French had certain axes they wanted to grind, and since the British had given up, the French thought they could work a couple of angles. The colonists just simply wanted to be free of the whole mess and let the British and the French argue with one another about what they get. And so John Jay secretly negotiated with the British, you know, like Henry Kissinger with Lee Ducktoe. Yeah. He secretly negotiated with the British to work out the British-American agreement without the French knowing about it. And then all of a sudden, the American delegation surfaces with these articles, signs them, and out we were. And then it was between the French and the British how they were going to handle the rest of it. But our part of the business was settled. And Jay was the guy who handled the undercover negotiations. In 1784, the Continental Congress elected him Secretary for Foreign Affairs, yeah, Secretary of State. He was a delegate to the New York State's ratifying convention, and he made the motion to approve the new Constitution. And the New York delegation did approve it, but it took a lot of arguing on his part and on Alexander Hamilton's part to get the New York delegation to ratify the new Constitution. And once we operated under the new Constitution, John Jay was the first Chief Justice of the United States. Never amounted to much, I mean, never did anything particularly significant as Chief Justice. Wasn't until Marshall came along that the Supreme Court really came into its own. But he was the first Chief Justice and organized it. In 1794, he negotiated a treaty called the Jay Treaty with Great Britain, which finally settled our war debt with the British. He was very unpopular because he settled for more than the Americans thought they had coming, you know, which is understandable. And as a result of this, he ruined his political career because he was generally accepted as the man who would be second president of the United States, that he would replace Washington. And it is because of this treaty, which was very unpopular, that his political career was done. And while he was elected governor of New York from 1795 to 1801, this was the end of his political career. And his last years he spent in retirement in his large palatial New York estate. He was a very conservative Federalist, a haughty aristocrat. He was very much afraid of democracy, and he was in favor of a strong central government with a strong military and a good foreign policy, as you might have expected, see, being that kind of a diplomat. That's the second guy. The third guy, who wrote 29 of the articles and probably the best written of the whole batch, was James Madison, fourth president of the United States. And James was sort of halfway between Hamilton and Jay in his age. He was born in 1751, so he was 4 years older than Alexander Hamilton, and he died in 1836. He is generally called the father of the United States Constitution because he wrote much of it. He was from Virginia. He was a good friend of Thomas Jefferson, 1769, he attended the university, which later on would be called Princeton, and he graduated in 1771. He continued studies in Virginia after this in the areas of religion and law. He was a very pious man. In 1776, he was elected to the committee which wrote the Virginia State Constitution. Now, as soon as the Declaration of Independence had been passed in 1776, roughly July 4th, although it was really August that it got enough votes to be passed. But as soon as that one was passed, all the states immediately considered themselves free agents. And so they all started writing their state constitutions and functioning as independent countries, running a kind of loose confederation through the Continental Congress. And the Articles of Confederation were really, just the regulations for the loose alliance. But the individual states decided whether they're going to contribute any money to the war or any manpower to the war or not, whether they would support the federal government, whether the federal government could contract this debt or that debt. So the federal government really had very little power, and the federal government was the Continental Congress. And that's all it was. Everything else was state government. So Madison was on the Virginia State Constitution Committee, and he was rather influential there, and he wrote the article on religious freedom. The article guaranteeing religious freedom to all citizens of Virginia, forbidding a state religion or discrimination or favoritism for one religion over another, and eliminating the religious oath for holding political office. Thomas Jefferson was very proud of him for that. In 1779, he was elected to the Continental Congress, and he was in the Continental Congress until 1783. During his term of office, he sponsored a lot of legislation, none of which passed, because all the legislation which he proposed was legislation giving more power to the central government, and it just didn't get through. He returned to the Virginia legislature, where he was influential in preventing the Episcopal Church from getting special status in the state of Virginia, and also was influential in getting legislation passed which prevented financial assistance being given to any church. Imagine today, where we have debates about whether there can be any federal assistance in any way, shape, or form to education that is, even remotely church-related. Back in those days, they were arguing about whether churches could get subsidized. Churches, not educational institutions, but churches get subsidized by the state government, as was the case in Europe. All right, he was elected to the Annapolis Convention. Now, the Annapolis Convention is a convention not too well known, which occurred the year before the Philadelphia Convention. And it was called by the invitation of Maryland and Virginia. First, they were going to invite five states to get together because they were running into all kinds of commerce problems with Chesapeake Bay, because the federal government, as they had it, had no authority to regulate interstate commerce, none whatsoever. So it had to be worked out by agreement between the states. So they were going to invite the states that surrounded there, particularly Virginia, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and so on. Then they decided to invite all 13 states and make it a convention on interstate commerce and see if they could adopt some kinds of general rules and regulations so they could get rid of some of the problems they were running into. About 9 states showed up for it. One of the states that didn't show up for it was Maryland, the host state. Can you imagine that? Annapolis is in Maryland, and Maryland's delegation never showed up. That shows you how terrific organization they had back in those days. And even when a delegation did show up, if they felt like going fishing for a month or two, they went fishing. That didn't bother them that they weren't at sessions. They're very casual about getting organized. Okay. One of the things that the Annapolis Convention did achieve was that it passed a motion which was referred back to the 13 states that they have a constitutional convention the following year at Philadelphia to try and put a little more beef in the Articles of Confederation so that it would, they would be workable. And so that was what got the Philadelphia Convention started. In 1787, he wrote a paper on the basis of research about ancient and modern confederacies. And as a result of his research, he came to the conclusion that a confederacy was one of the weakest forms of government you could have, and that they had to do away with the confederacy, which they had, and adopt a different form of government that would have more stability. He reflects his paper in a number of the articles which he wrote. He drew up a plan for a new constitution, which was presented, for a totally new constitution, which was presented shortly after the convention began. It was presented by a man named Edmund Randolph from Virginia, and so it became known as the Randolph Plan, although Madison wrote it. One section was immediately removed. Al will appreciate this. The section which was removed was a section which forbade the importation or possession of slaves as of about 1800. And that was immediately removed. That was a little premature. So that was taken out. Nobody even debated that one except Madison. He talked more than anybody else did at Philadelphia. He also kept notes. He summarized everybody's presentation and told in what order they talked, what they said, and how long they talked. And his notes were so good that in 1843, Congress found out about his notes and they authorized his notes to be published at government expense. Now, one of the ironies about this is that at the time when Marshall was Chief Justice of the United States, the question of the status of the Supreme Court was raised. What is the function of the Supreme Court? Is the Supreme Court the one who interprets the Constitution, or is the President of the United States the one who decides what the Constitution means? Shades of a year or two ago, right? And who decides what the Constitution means? The Supreme Court went to the United States Constitution. They found no answer. It was ambiguous. Madison's notes were unknown. They went to the Federalist Papers, one of the articles that we'll talk about on Saturday, a paper written by Alexander Hamilton. And on the basis of Alexander Hamilton's argument about the relationship of the Supreme Court to the Constitution, the Supreme Court found that it is the final arbiter of what the Constitution means. And that has never been challenged since. But they based it on the Federalist Papers, which had no legal status whatsoever. And that's where we quit this morning. I'll finish with Hamilton and some more about the Federalist Papers, and then I will talk about the view of man, and I'll talk a little bit about why we've got to talk about the view of man when you talk about American constitutional theory, and then I'll talk about faction, which is the key idea. And the control of faction is the purpose of a constitution.